Isn't the Bible sexist? Well, in one sense, yes, it is. And maybe it surprises you to hear me say that, but there is no doubt that the Bible contains material which is sexist. Let me give you just one example. At one point, Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation, has to head off to Egypt because of a famine. So he says to his wife Sarai, I know how beautiful you are, so when the Egyptians see you, they will want to bump me off so that you are available for them. So let's pretend that you are my sister, and then I will be looked after along with you. Well, before long, the government officials recommend this rare beauty to Pharaoh, and he takes her into his palace. And sure enough, Abraham is well looked after. But then Pharaoh and his household get sick, and they start asking some questions, and they discover that Sarai is in fact Abraham's wife. Pharaoh summons him in and says, what have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you tell me she was your sister? I took her to be my wife. And he sends them packing. Now, I'm sure we'll agree that that is an appalling way for a man to treat his wife. To pretend that she is his sister, and then to keep silent as Pharaoh takes her as his wife. It is appalling. And the Old Testament includes stories that are even worse than that. Cases of rape and dreadful violence against women. So yes, the Bible contains stuff which is sexist, which is misogynistic. But just including it doesn't mean that the Bible writer is endorsing it. A lot of the Old Testament is narrative. The writer is simply recording what happened, warts and all. And it doesn't always say Abraham did something which was terribly wicked. It just records what happens. Although in this case, the writer tells us that it was God who sent the illness to Pharaoh's household. And the fact that Abraham ends up being told off by a pagan ruler is the writer's indication, a way of saying that something has gone terribly wrong. As I say, it's not explicitly stated. The clues are there. So yes, some of the Bible contains sexist material, sexist behaviour. But that doesn't mean that such behaviour is approved of. Incidentally, the fact that so many of the Bible's heroes fail so badly, I mean, think of David's adultery with Bathsheba or Peter's denial of Jesus, that shows that their acceptance by God is based on God's kindness, God's undeserved favour. Otherwise, there would have been no hope for them. God's favour is only ever the way for us to be accepted. Okay, so the Bible contains sexist behaviour, but don't let that mislead you into thinking that it approves of such behaviour. It doesn't. Let's have a look at how Jesus treated women. And I'm not sure that we always appreciate just how groundbreaking that is. Once Jesus was travelling with his disciples through a region called Samaria, and at the middle of the day, they arrive at a town. Jesus sits down at the well, and his disciples go off to buy some lunch. And when a local woman comes to get water, Jesus starts a conversation with her. And we think nothing of that. That's like a couple of people passing the time of day with each other at the bus stop. Except that when the disciples return, we're told that they were surprised to find him talking with a woman. That's a revealing little sentence, isn't it? The culture of the day was that if you were a man, you did not talk publicly to a woman. It was beneath you. And for those of you who know the story, there is also a racial barrier here as well. But Jesus breaks through those barriers. Here he is affirming this woman, radically against the culture of his day. Not only that he talks to her, but also the topic of the conversation. He discusses great theological truths with her, such that this woman is the very first person in John's Gospel to whom the identity of Jesus is revealed. She says, "I know that Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I who speak to you am he." We cannot underestimate how radical this was. Here is Jesus turning the cultural taboos on their head by talking to this woman. And this was typical of his attitude and approach, seen by him including women amongst his followers, his disciples. There's a contemporary statement from a Jewish rabbi. If a man gives his daughter a knowledge of the law, God's law, it's as though he taught her lechery. That was the culture of the day. And by contrast, Jesus makes a habit of teaching women, revealing great truths to women. Let me give you one more example. In Luke's Gospel, we read of two sisters, Mary and Martha. And we're told that Mary sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he said. Much to her sister's annoyance, actually. Now, that little phrase, to sit at the feet of, was how you spoke of being a student. The Apostle Paul later describes himself as educated at the feet of Gamaliel. So the clear implication is that Mary is affirmed as worthy of Jesus's theological instruction. We think, well, of course. But at the time, it was groundbreaking. Here's a little snippet from, again, from Luke's Gospel. Jesus travelled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who'd been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. Joanna, the wife of Chusa, the manager of Herod's household. Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means. Here are women being mentioned by name amongst Jesus' followers, being acknowledged for their financial support of Jesus' ministry. Well, again, contrast that with contemporary views. Ben Sirach of Jerusalem said, "Bad temper, insolence and shame hold sway where the wife supports her husband." But we see Jesus gladly welcoming female disciples and supporters. And following on from this, it was women who played an important and prominent role as witness to the central events of Jesus' mission. It was a group of women who stood at the foot of the cross, watching Jesus die, and hearing his last words. It was a group of women who went to the tomb that first Easter Sunday morning and first witnessed the empty tomb and the risen living Lord Jesus. The culture of the day was that the word of a woman was less reliable, her witness not accepted in a court of law. highly significant then that the central events of Jesus' death and resurrection were first witnessed at first hand by women. But just how new is Jesus in his attitude? On one occasion, Jesus was asked about divorce. Some Pharisees asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason?" There were some rabbis who thought that a man, and it was the man, could divorce his wife just because he no longer wanted her, or because she burnt the toast. As trivial as that. And obviously, such one-sided divorce laws were very demeaning to women, very detrimental to their status. How does Jesus reply? Well, he replies by quoting the Old Testament from the very first chapter of Genesis, in fact. "Haven't you read," he said, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female?" It's just worth reading the quote from the beginning. Verse 26, "Then God said, 'Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness.' So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God he created them, male and female he created them." Notice God says, "Let us make mankind in our image." Father, Son, and Holy Spirit consulting together. And part of being in the image of God is reflecting that relational nature of God, the three-personed God. And that's brought out in those three lines of poetry that are there, each one building on the previous one. So the mankind God created in his image is male and female. It's not just the man who's said to be made in the image of God. It's not just the woman who's said to be made in the image of God. It is male and female together who image God, the relational God. And together rule over God's creation. So, right at the beginning, the fundamental equality of man and woman is being stressed. Male and female, equally created by God in his image. And what a noble calling. What a great dignity given to male and female. To be imaging God. What does God think of it all? Well, very soon it says God saw all that he had made and it was very good. There is God's foundational assessment of all human beings. Very good. In Genesis chapter 2, the particular roles of men and women, particularly within marriage, begin to emerge. The man as lead, and the woman as the helper. But in no way is that an inferior role, because elsewhere God is described as the helper. So different roles for men and women within a marriage and within family life. God's good design for us. But that does not do away with the fundamental equality between man and woman that has been so clearly established and stated in Genesis chapter 1. I think one of the reasons we struggle with this is because in our culture we equate role with value. So when we meet somebody for the first time, we want to find out what they do so we know where to put them in the pecking order. And there's, you know, lawyers and university professors and doctors up there somewhere and traffic wardens down at the bottom. But the Bible doesn't think like that. The Bible stresses the fundamental equality of all people, regardless of role or looks or intelligence or net worth or income or ability. And thinking about it, do any of us really want to equate role with value? Surely we don't want to say that the wealthy CEO is somehow more valuable than someone who's disabled and out of work? Or that the beautiful film star is more valuable than the elderly woman or the newborn baby? Even though we often live in a way that assigns value according to role, deep down we know better than that. Deep down we often long that our value is not linked to the roles we play or the positions we hold. And that longing is met in the truths of Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Different roles, equal value, equal worth. So every human being made in the image of God. And we need to add that that image is now tarnished, now damaged by what happened in the next chapter of the Bible, Genesis chapter 3. Not just eating a bit of fruit, but mankind's rebellion against God. That thus breaks their relationship with God and damages their relationship with one another. So Adam, who had failed to speak against the devil's lies, he now blames his wife. And she in turn shifts the blame. The serpent deceived me and I ate it. Innocence and intimacy replaced by shame and blame. And now God says that that pattern of sin and conflict that they have chosen will persist. He says to the woman, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. And at first reading, that sounds a little bit sort of lopsided. The woman desires her husband, whilst he rules over her. But that same word, desire, occurs in the very next chapter, where God says to Cain, sin is crouching at your door, it desires to have you, but you must rule over it. So it's desire in the sense of possessing and mastering. Gone is the unashamed, united love story between man and woman. Now it is conflict. Here is the battle of the sexes. It's the result of their rebellion. It's not God's original design. But doesn't that kind of lead to the denigration of women? Well, I sense, in one sense, yes, it does. Throughout the Bible, we see sin resulting in appalling treatment of women by men. But as I said earlier, the Bible does not endorse what it reports. It presents a realistic picture of how sadly we human beings treat one another. In particular, how we misuse power when it is given to us. Women are right to be outraged by abuse and violence against them. But God is infinitely more angry at such sin. His good design for men and women has been wrecked. Now, thankfully, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, he has launched a wonderful plan of restoration, which will one day bring about Eden restored. So we've looked at Jesus' treatment of women. But what about the rest of the New Testament? Well, perhaps not surprisingly, Jesus' radical endorsement of women continues. The Apostle Paul includes 9 women among the ministry partners that he lists at the end of his letter to the church at Rome. One example of the major role that women played in the spread of first century Christianity. The New Testament churches had leadership teams. And again, against the culture of the times, those teams included women. So Phoebe, for example, is described as a deacon and a patron of many. We see the Apostle Paul giving advice to women on how they were to prophesy in the church at Corinth. So taking an active part in the meetings seems pretty ordinary to us. But at the time, it was radical. There's a similar ordering in the church family, as we've seen in human families. So the overall teaching and leadership is entrusted to an appropriate male. But that is a difference of role, not of value. And so this first century faith proved highly attractive to women. The sociologist Rodney Stark has shown that the early church was majority female. That's particularly striking because the Roman world was disproportionately male due to selective female infanticide and the high proportion of deaths in childbirth. But the church was predominantly female. Early Christianity was mocked by outsiders because of its appeal to women. The Greek philosopher Celsus said that Christians want and are able to convince only the foolish, dishonourable and stupid, only slaves, women and little children. And other critics said that Christianity attracted the dregs of the populace and credulous women with the inability natural to their sex. Here is the church being criticised for being attractive to women. At the time the New Testament was written, Roman fathers routinely gave their daughters away as child brides. Men could force their wives to have abortions, could force them to abandon sick or disabled or female babies. Here's a quote from a letter from a seemingly devoted Roman husband to his wife. I ask and beg you to take good care of our baby son, and as soon as I receive payment, I shall send it to you. If you are delivered of a child, if it is a boy, keep it. If it is a girl, discard it. You've sent me word, don't forget me. How can I forget you? I beg you not to worry. If it is a girl, discard it. At the time, there was no expectation that husbands would be faithful to their wives. It was commonplace for them to use both male and female slaves for sex, and they would be expected to have a mistress. So Paul's instructions on marriage, that men be faithful to their wives, be sacrificial in their approach to them, was outrageous in the culture of the day. Shocking in its elevation of women, but liberating and life-giving compared to the exploitation and abuse suffered by so many at the time. It was a culture where a privileged male elite had sexual access to everyone else, and those who didn't could hire prostitutes for pathetically small amounts of money. But with the rise of Christianity, the buying and selling of sex was forbidden. It held men and women to an equal standard and gave equal dignity to men and women. All of this was revolutionary. Under Christian influence, Emperor Constantine introduced legal protections for women and for marriage. Women began to secure property rights and guardianship of their children, who had previously been seen as the possession of the man. Under Emperor Valentinian, husbands lost the right of life or death over their families, including their wives. Radically, the one exploiting the prostitute was counted as guilty. And by 428 AD, everyone, whatever their social status, could claim legal protection from sexual predators, and so on. Now, let's not paint too rosy a picture. As in every other ethical area, the church has under-delivered on its promise to women. Denigrating and patronizing attitudes have all too often infected church culture, and selective readings of the Bible have allowed men to spread misogynistic views. But Christianity has also played a role in championing women's rights from the first century until today. The early feminism of the 1920s, which gained American women the right to property and to vote, was due in large part to Christian involvement. The same goes for the abolitionist movement, as Christian leaders like Sojourner Truth advocated for women's rights. Yes, true Christianity, wherever it has gone, has turned the tables on the marginalization of women that happens in many traditional cultures, arising out of that equal status before God. And at the heart of the Bible are the words of a man who laid down his life, lays down his life for billions of women who have trusted him with theirs. Is the Bible sexist? Does Christianity denigrate women? I suggest on the contrary, it lifts us, men and women, into fellowship with God. It calls us into partnership with God in the glorious task of building his church and loving others in his name.